Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Bishop Anton Schneider took the religious name Athanasius. He was born in the Soviet Union, went to seminary in Austria, served as a priest in Brazil, and was consecrated a bishop in Kazakhstan, where he's also General Secretary of the Bishops' Conference. His childhood was instrumental in giving him a sense of the importance of resistance in the face of the progressive totalitarianism of the Soviet Union. His parents were ethnic Germans, originally settled near the Black Sea, but in the aftermath of the Second World War found themselves deported to a labour camp in the Urals. Later, the whole family were much involved in the underground church in the Soviet Union. And as a boy, Schneider and his three siblings would attend clandestine masses with their parents, often travelling up to 60 miles from the family's home to join the liturgy. As it happened, during the early 1980s, I too travelled the Soviet Union smuggling Bibles and catechetical books for underground seminaries and became deeply impressed by the heroism and clarity of vision of the underground Catholics and Orthodox I met. To our collective surprise, the forces of progressive totalitarianism have in some mysterious way morphed from the East, where the system collapsed after 70 years in 1989, to the West, where, in what appears to be an act of collective naivety and cultural betrayal, our society is welcoming the restrictions of speech and conscience. An even greater surprise is the extent to which the Church has started to succumb to these translated demons of totalitarian, moral and intellectual asphyxia. Bishop Schneider has emerged as a sane and holy voice of opposition in the Catholic Church to this corruption of its belief and faith. He's just been on a whirlwind tour of these British islands and agreed to talk to the Catholic Herald's podcast. We didn't have much time. His schedule is packed. He's much in demand. How does he evaluate what's happening in the church today? As you'll hear from our conversation, he believes there's been a coup, a takeover from within the Vatican. What evidence is there for this? A church that was in part defined for the clarity of its moral and doctrinal teaching has been characterized in the last decade by ambiguity at best and what some have discerned as chaos at worst. As a bishop, Athanasius Schneider has responded to the needs of his people by recently publishing a refreshed form of the Catechism called Credo. I asked him why he felt the need to make the Catechism available in this form and how he saw the present struggle for the soul of the Church. And he joins me now. Your Eminence, Bishop Schneider, thank you very much for coming and joining us. You're on a very busy tour. And I want to begin by asking you to explain what lay behind your catechism. Bishops do sometimes produce catechisms, and this one comes at a fairly critical point in the life of the Church. I've heard you explain that you wrote it by invitation, by demand. The people asked for it. Bishop, why are the people asking for a catechism?
Yes, this is an evident sign that we are living in a time of confusion regarding doctrine and morals. And so a demand of simple people, of parents and family fathers and mothers who were asking me to write a catechism with clear answers, also regarding some issues of our time, typical of our time, which are confused. And so this is for me a revealing sign that we are living in a time of great confusion within the church even. And therefore, I considered it as one of my first duties as a bishop to transmit the true Catholic faith in its integrity and clarity. And so I did this oath in my episcopal consecration, as every Catholic bishop is promising during the consecration. He says, I promise to transmit the deposit of faith integrally, faithfully, as it was handed down to me and as the Church always taught in all times. So this oath I gave, and when I heard these voices of people and they asked me, I was reminding this my oath of my episcopal consecration. Of course, I accepted this request and I did this even with joy to fulfill my duty as bishop.
We both know that the age we live in is a time of confusion. Any age that can philosophically give rise to something so problematic as postmodernity and this effusion of relativism we find ourselves in is going to be an age of confusion. We expect that in the world. We don't expect it in the church. Can you give us some great understanding of why the church is finding itself mirroring something of the world in its own confusion? There are clearly going to be theological, psychological, and spiritual reasons, but for a lot of people, it's not what they expect of the Catholic Church.
Exactly. We have already the warning from St. Paul the Apostle, and I think these warnings, which I now will quote, must remain for all times very important and still a living voice and echo. Namely, St. Paul wrote in his letter to the Romans, to the Christians of that time, inclusively, of course, to all the pastors and faithful, do not conform yourself to the world. In Latin, non conformamini spiritu. This warning, do not conform yourself to the mind, to the thinking of this world. This is exactly the reason, I mean, that in our day, in the last probably decades even, those in responsibility in the church did not take as serious this apostolic warning and tried to adapt in some points the truth of the gospel of all times to the spirit of our age, which is basically the spirit of relativism, denial of constant truth itself, and the spirit of naturalism, a kind of denial of the supernatural world and revelation itself. And this all goes together to this attitude, which we can say the anthropocentrism, to make human thinking the center and the measure of all, without subjecting his thinking to God, to the revealing God, who revealed himself in Jesus Christ and in the teaching which the church kept through the ages. So I think this is an omission on the part of those in responsibility and authority in the church, or they were not vigilant enough to protect the church from this infiltration of this spirit of relativism and anthropocentrism and naturalism, or worse, they became themselves those who propagated this spirit of the world actively in the life of the church. And the faithful, those who truly want to believe in Jesus Christ and love the faith, they are feeling this is not the voice of Christ. And Jesus Christ said about the good shepherds, the sheep are listening and knowing the voice of the good shepherd. The voice of the fake shepherds, the faithful will not listen and not follow. So those faithful who still are keeping this profound sense of faith.
I want to ask you a question about the Second Vatican Council, and it's not a trick question, it's a sincere question, but I'm aware that the Council has become a totem, really, for both sides. When I was an Anglican theologian looking at the Second Vatican Council, I remember thinking, well, this is a very good step forward because the Catholic Church is becoming more like the world and more like the Protestant tradition, and so there's a greater rapprochement between us. Having seen both the world collapse and the Protestant churches collapse, it began to be a question for me as to whether that rapprochement was a good thing. Having become a Catholic from the inside, one of the ways in which I've been trying to understand the Council is to ask the question whether or not the Council Fathers knew what they were doing when they began to try and build a bridge of rapprochement to the world. In other words, the world that you and I grew up in when we were young looked dangerous, but not lethal. But as we've grown older, that dangerousness has become lethal. I certainly underestimated the forces of secularism, both ideological and spiritual. Would it be fair to say that there was an act of underestimation within the Vatican Council, which was, of course, a very mixed matter? But nonetheless, The relativist proponents seem to see it as an inviolable operation that caused only good. Many of the faithful see it as a hostage to secular fortune. Clearly, both are true at the same time, but can you offer some kind of interpretation as to how the faithful look at this issue that we're often invited to think of as either continuity or rupture in order to find some intellectual or theological coherence?
Yes, I am agreeing with you. It is first partly an underestimation of the true spirit of this world. 60 years ago, the Council Fathers, underestimation of the spirit, as you mentioned, of the relativism and naturalism. And then I think partly also naive. And another cause I would see also a kind of complex of inferiority towards the world. So you could observe in a part of the statements of the behavior of some council fathers, of those who were probably also influential, a kind of to be applauded by the world, to seek sympathy, to beg sympathy, even I would say, by the world. And this is not the true authentic attitude of the apostles, of Jesus Christ, the apostles, and the church. The church has always lived and behaved herself through the centuries. Of course, we should invite those who are not believing and to propose them inviting manner, but clear manner, the truth of Christ and the gospel, but without ambiguity. And this is, I think, the error, the methodical error of so many affirmations of the council, or the basic approach. They wanted to invite the world and then speaking in a kind of ambiguous language in order to probably to gain those who are in the world. But this is an error, because a true, authentic seeker who is seeking Christ and the truth, even outside the church, he wants clarity because he is seeking the truth. And we can propose the truth, of course, with love, but with clarity, it is possible. And this is, I think, this was the methodical error of the council to have chosen this way of, in some way, ambiguity. And this is the cause of the consequent effects and developments in we are living since the council in many areas, liturgy and others, pastoral, in ambiguity and avoiding clarity. But Christ is himself the clear truth. And this is God and the truth which is setting us free, and the truth gives us joy. And for example, for ambiguity, no one will give his life. But for clarity and for truth, this did the first Christians, the apostles, and all the martyrs whom we know. England is famous of the confessors and martyrs, Thomas More. He did not yield to nothing ambiguous in his situation. John Fisher and these good martyrs from other countries also. And therefore, I think the method of Vatican II basically did not work, because we saw the consequences.
For many of us who have converted and become Catholics, it's because we discovered that our views about sex were secularized and mistaken. And through much of my lifetime, my culture looked at the Catholic Church and thought, you are too rigid, you are too dogmatic about sex. But now, with the addiction to sex in our culture, and also this extraordinary move by which identity politics uses sexual desire to offer some form of anthropological labeling to humankind, it almost seems as though only the Catholic Church has had the discipline and the resources to confront this very powerful force. And yet, just at the moment, just at the very moment when we need the clarity of the Catholic Church understanding about sexual desire and sexual identity, it seems as though ambiguity has been released. The question I have at the moment is that having read Instrumentorum Laboris and seen that it was couched in the language of the psychotherapist's discipline, and wondering why it should have chosen to clothe itself in that philosophical structure. I thought everything was lost. But then suddenly, recently, in those last couple of weeks, the German bishops has received quite a strong letter saying that the ethics of homosexual attraction remain in place. And as St. John Paul II said, the issue of the demands of feminism will not be met. I was very surprised to read that letter because it seemed to be not part of the trajectory. Are there different voices in Rome? Are there different theological power structures? Is the incoherence here a sign of internal theological debate within the Vatican, or is there another explanation for it? Because it's quite difficult to put these two things together and reconcile them.
Yes, I am very thankful for this letter of the Secretariat of State. And really, it is a sign that really the Holy See is still in some way in the hands of God, and not only by the hostile takeover, which occurred probably to some extent. The Holy See is a kind of victim of hostile takeover. These are the words of Cardinal Müller, and he is living in Rome. And I'm agreeing. So the forces, anti-Christian forces, who want to adapt completely the Catholic faith and morals and life to this world, this modern world, which no values, basically, they are promoting this. They have some powers and responsibilities in the Vatican, of course. They manage to occupy these positions. And unfortunately, Pope Francis is allowing them or even putting them in such positions, people who are evidently not more Catholic thinking, that they are promoting this ambiguity, even heresies. But in the same time, there are, of course, in Rome, of course, still some cardinals and bishops who are concerned and who want to keep the mission of the See of Peter, which was always called, since the beginning, the cathedra in Latin veritatis. So this is the seat of truth. This is the mission of Peter and his successor, and this will remain. Currently, in some way, it is obfuscated or eclipsed partly, but this will pass again. And I think that the faithful, the simple faithful, they will strengthen again those in authority in the church, the fidelity of, I call the little ones in the church. And this is the beautiful sign that the church is divine, that we are one body, and this church is ultimately indestructible. It is now suffering, of course, attacks and troubles, but this will pass. We simply have to stick to the truth which we know of the good catechisms. Therefore, I presented a catechism of the voice of all time, and this will help again to stick to the faith of the apostles, the faith of the saints, and this alone will last and endure.
Bishop Fulton Sheen prophesied, it seems quite accurately, that the church would come to a point when it needed the faithful laity to remind their priests of how to be priests, and indeed even their bishops of how to be bishops. And the publication of your credo is an example of that mutual codependence that he was talking about. It's interesting that you talk in such forthright terms of a coup inside the Vatican, as does Cardinal Müller. Are you finding any support with other bishops? Because clearly, if there's a coup, it's just one of those normal power struggles. Everyone's used to them, and they happen at work, in families, in politics. Of course, they happen in the church too. We have the Holy Spirit and the promises of Jesus to rely on. But at a pragmatic level, have you found yourself being supported by other bishops in this time of ambiguity and crisis?
Yes, thanks be to God. There are bishops who have the same concern and the same attitude towards the truth of the Catholic faith. There are, I know them, but the majority of them, they are living in a kind of intimidation because We have now witnessed the situation of Bishop Strickland from Tyler, Texas. He spoke openly, and now the consequence was he was removed. And unfortunately, we are living in this time of intimidation, and the bishops are intimidated to speak openly and boldly, defending the Catholic truth. But there are basically many bishops still who are keeping the truth of the Catholic faith. Maybe they are working silently in order to save the situation of their diocese and wait that the situation in the Vatican will change positively, that God will again give us leadership in the Holy See, and popes who will really, clearly, courageously transmit the Catholic faith and defend the Catholic faith. And this will come, because the Church is in the hands of God.
This is very encouraging, and thank you for putting it so clearly. You said earlier on that nobody will die for ambiguity, and so of course it's a bit strange that a spirit of ambiguity and even chaos is to be found in the Vatican as part of this coup. This is a theological and a psychological question. We know the spiritual answer, but sometimes we have to divide things into different categories to get a clearer handle on them. When it comes to the next consistory, it would seem to a lot of people that it would be extraordinarily foolish to elect a pope who continued the present trajectory of the coup, because people don't die for ambiguity. They don't flourish with chaos. They do sacrifice themselves for the truth, for the living Christ. And therefore, anyone who cared for the Church, even as an institution faithful to its mission statement, would, as a matter of common sense, try and elect a CEO, a pope, a father who exemplified the strongest things in the faith. Is it psychologically likely that those cardinals who will be part of the voting conclave, will they be blind to what is obvious to most people? Or do you think in psychological or theological terms or political terms, they've yet to see the consequences of this particular papacy work out?
I think that even those cardinals who are not so, I would say, traditional-minded, they would prefer to have a pope with more clarity, because also in this pontificate, there were situations of the not observance of the common basic norms of the canon law regarding some bishops or cardinals who were removed, or other people, without any process, without any procedure of canonical norms. So a kind of arbitrary ruling, and this is very serious an issue. And even I think that those cardinals, even I repeat, who are not so traditional, they would have a pope who is at least observing authentically the rules, the procedures of the canon law. And then the other part, of course, would like have a pope who is more clear in doctrine. And this we hope that the Lord will guide the Church also in electing the next pope. And therefore we have also to pray since now already to implore this gift of God, who will give us at least a pope who will be more clear and more observant of the canon law, more paternal to and fraternal to the bishops, avoiding any ambiguity or absolutistic style of government over the brothers. And this, I think, is a very important issue which the cardinals in the next conclave will also consider.
Well, let's hope that this podcast is forwarded to each of the cardinals and they get to hear your advice directly as part of their preparation. Can I ask you before you go, because I know that you have a full program tonight, you've been visiting England and now you're in Ireland. What has been your impression of the people that you meet, the faithful who've come to listen to you and to talk to you?
I was in several places in England, and so I saw the simple people, young people, students, families, all the same. They are longing, really thirsting, for the clarity of the truth, for the beauty of the liturgy, for the true Christian life. So true Christianity, to be true Catholics, authentic. And this I met in those places here in England where I was, very clearly, and also the same situation all over the world where I am visiting other countries. And this is for me an encouraging sign that the Holy Spirit is guiding the church, and the sensus fidei, as sensus fidelium, this is a gift of God, a kind of instinct, Catholic instinct, which is the Lord is keeping in the people, in the young people, and this will remain. This is a sign of hope for a true renewal of the church, which will come with this new generation of new priests, new families, and hopefully new popes also.
Bishop Schneider, thank you so much for your Episcopal ministry, and thank you for all that you do. We hold you in our prayers. Thank you particularly for making time to have this conversation with us. God bless you.
God bless you also.